Chris Hayes.
Matt Welch, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm really good.
I am Matt Welch, for you viewers at home. I'm the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, the magazine for free minds and free markets. And I'm happy to be here with Chris Hayes of The Nation magazine, which I'll let you explain the subtitle or lack thereof.
The magazine of free minds. Stop.
Free minds and a mixed market.
The oldest continuously published magazine in America. How about that?
Is that true?
Yeah, it is.
I know it's the claim, but is it true?
Yeah, well, the thing is that Harper's actually was published, you know, started before. It was probably actually Harper's, I think it was like the first magazine in the country, but it has gone through A, several incarnations, and B, stopped publishing for a period.
And The Atlantic, would that just come later? Or?
That also went through, that actually went through a long period where it didn't publish, I think.
Okay.
But maybe someone will fact check this in comments, I'm sure.
That's helpful. Now The Nation had itself a great Bush presidency. At the very
least,
in terms of circulation.
Well, yeah, circulation-wise, it certainly did.
I mean,
the slogan around the office that we always use is that what's bad for the country is good for the nation.
Yeah. So, we might be experiencing the same thing in a different way.
I'm sure. I would be shocked. I mean, I'd be shocked if you guys didn't see a very significant increase in circulation.
Well, not to get sidetracked to begin with, but it is interesting. Certain metrics are definitely up for us. We don't have the benefit of or the burden of strict partisan affiliation.
Yeah.
So, we spent probably The Nation and Reason were two of the most strongly anti-Bush magazines during his presidency.
Right, right,
and so it wasn't as if we were rallying the troops around the guy. We don't at the same time stand to benefit from beating up on another guy. But as long as economics is the issue, and it has been for at least, 15 months or whatever you want to put since Bear Stearns, then there's definitely an appetite for it. But the news this week is Afghanistan, Chris Hayes.
That's right.
And The Nation, as a long-standing supporter of long overseas invasions of countries, how would you describe the sort of staff and reader reaction to begin with, and then maybe get onto the policy of Obama doubling down in Afghanistan?
Well, yeah. Well, so this, the magazine has been really actually very focused on de-escalating in Afghanistan and preventing further escalation for a while, I'd say starting even during the campaign and paying very careful attention to the things that were being said then and pointing out that they were bad ideas, because a lot of the groundwork was laid for this in the campaign.
Do you feel like, just to interject, I covered the Democratic convention, I think you did too, I forget. But I was walking around going to nothing but foreign policy things, because that's the issue that I sort of cared about the most. And I was just shocked how little interest there was among non-journalists, certainly among convention goers. But like, if you just talk to the average person enthusiastic about Obama, there was little understanding that he was every day campaigning on exactly what he has done, which is doubling down in Afghanistan and using that as sort of the locus point on terror and making smarter war and all that stuff.
Yeah, no, I think that was an overlooked part of the program, I think, for a few reasons. I mean, I think some of the, there's one narrative of that, which I feel like is a little condescending, which is sort of people, I think, both on the right and then also kind of the sort of left, the more radical left that always kind of viewed Obama with everything from skepticism to disdain, that, this was sort of the willful blindness of the hope-addled masses. But, look, there's preference hierarchies always, and I think that, Iraq was sort of crowded out other concerns. B, I think as the campaign went forward, domestic concerns grew larger. And I think even now what you're going to see, it'll be interesting because, the war is unpopular. It's certainly unpopular amongst the liberal base, but it's unpopular broadly among the population. But I think its salience is actually fairly low. I mean, this is actually part of the problem with the fact that we have kind of constructed the American national security state in such a way that the burden of these engagements can be fairly narrowly focused.
Or narrowly felt.
Yes, exactly. Right. Like, that's right. That's right. Narrowly felt, I should say, at home.
Yeah.
not narrowly felt in the countries in which we're doing the fighting. But and so, you know, it's one of these things where I think Afghanistan, speaking for both for, I think, well, less for our readership, but if you want to enlarge into the kind of democratic base, even if people are angry about it, I think it remains disconcertingly abstract. And part of that, it's very hard. It is hard to blame people in the sense that, like, times are really economically tough and people are focused in a more immediate way at home. But I think, so I think that there's a lot of outrage, frustration. There is a sense of betrayal among some people. There is a kind of, we told you so amongst others. But it was a very kind of toxic, sour week in the world of kind of left politics, I think.
What besides Afghanistan would you point to? I think
because of the speech. I think that the speech, I think it was the first speech that, even when there were speeches that were given by the president in which people didn't agree or they felt he was being too cautious, civil liberties, this was the first speech the president gave that really, like, it was just hard to listen to and feel any affinity for, I will say. You know, and I think that was a really dispiriting experience.
Well, I'd say one part of that is, and this might sound a little off the wall, but there's a point, rhetorically, the speech was sort of in the camp of realism, right?
Yes,
it's a point that a critic of his policy, Glenn Greenwald, made, and I think correctly. He was sort of happy that we didn't talk about, you know, freeing Muslim women and stuff. And if you think about it, that is a pretty sour thing to be happy about. So you have the, I mean, realism as practiced and as defended is a pretty sour looking thing. I mean, there's always, and it's one of the many reasons why there isn't any real political isolationism or anti-interventionism anymore in this country. There's a lot of things that are, that contribute to that. But one of them is that there's just something that's viscerally unappealing about saying that, you know, look, we're going to limit our viewpoints or our scope. We're not going to couch this in these stirring ways that Americans periodically have been moved by.
That's exactly right.
While you're also doing the unrealism thing of actually doubling down your troop levels and kind of pledging, you might think or he might think concretely, but I think other skeptics would see as vaguely, to leave in 2011. So you've got like the sourness of realism without the actuality of realism, and that's difficult to swallow in any pleasant way, I think.
I think that's a very spot on analysis. I think, and it's interesting to view the ways in which, you know, I think you can't overstate the degree to which, you know, everything happens in the shadow of the Iraq War and its effect on people's thinking. And, you know, I find myself, you know, and I don't, you know, I do not focus on or specialize in foreign policy in terms of my reporting. I know as much about it as a curious consumer of this kind of content does. But, you know, I found for myself that I think, you know, I think I looked much more askance at realism before the Iraq War than I do now. you know, because of the ways in which these sort of humanitarian arguments, I think, were appropriated and manipulated in these really awful and nefarious ways in Iraq, it sort of discredited the general rhetoric or thinking around them, kind of in a guilt by association, and also in the extent to which you realize their power for harm in terms of selling really, really terrible ideas. So, but I completely agree that it's realism is a tough ideology or worldview to get super psyched about.
Yeah, and it's also unclear, I think, you know, what is going to eventually hold sway. I mean, on some days, Obama sounds like a realist, again, in a crowd unpleasing way, during the Iranian student demonstrations, he was just really cautious. Spent quite a few days before kind of ramping up rhetoric to even a level of concern. And that's not very attractive. I mean, Americans want to, and take all like personal beliefs about what the policy should be. We want to identify with freedom fighters. I think it's a very human emotion, and in many ways a correct one. There are many people who will say, well, that's the first precondition to all kinds of nefarious things. But it's unclear, and I found this in the reporting during the campaign and the conventions, it's unclear how this stuff is going to, like the sort of realism tendency or fight is going to play out in the administration going forward. I think in every case of every president in modern history, whoever is on the outside campaigning to get in is always going to call for the more humble foreign policy, right? It's like they're always going to get tough on China. Right. They're always going to do X, Y, and Z. And then once they're in office, they start maybe with a mixed to slightly humble foreign policy, and they gradually ramp up, and they never get tough on China, whatever the hell that means. We'll talk about that in a bit. But also just in discussions in Denver, you know, Madeleine Albright was the one leading these discussions, and she is a huge Wilsonian, you know, or a Munich mindsetted person, which is just a narrow tissue of membrane between that and neoconservatism, which I think a lot of people elide to their own sense of use. But Wilsonianism is the same. It's sort of a liberal interventionism. You're doing it out of humanitarian concerns and wanting to stop Hitler and all this kind of stuff. And, I mean, there's not a huge difference between that and a Paul, you know, Wolfowitz approach, except that, you know, one has the fuck France t-shirt and the other one doesn't. And it's unclear, like, how much of an Albrightian tendency there is now or is going to be in the Obama administration. And I would submit that the news this week and the results this week, which is no matter how you slice it, it's a doubling down of troops in a place that has had zero kind of good history of a huge foreign troop presence accomplishing much. I don't see any kind of limiting of the America unipower interventionism going forward. And when the next conflict happens, I don't know what's going to govern Obama's hand, but I have no reason to believe that he's going to be shy about using it.
I would say two things. One is that I think you're very right about this desire, which I think is actually fomented a lot by the press. This desire to kind of speak out on behalf of freedom, you know, those standing up for freedom everywhere. I think there's a kind of moral vanity involved in that is there's both something really admirable and noble about it. And I feel it too. I think we all felt it watching what was going on in Iran, felt it when the wall came down in Berlin in 89 and watching Solidarity and, in Tiananmen. I mean, any time where you watch that happen, you would, I think, be there'd be something strange if you didn't feel a deep sense of solidarity with the people that are kind of facing down the barrel of the gun. At the same time, I think that it's important to make the distinction between solidarity being offered by civil society, you know, by you and me writing in the magazine and these things, and the head of the American Imperium, which is has a whole host of other sort of complicating entanglements. And then the second point about, I think the point you're making about the way in which sort of the candidate outsider and the president insider differ is extremely apt, and I think is part of a larger phenomenon, which you might want to call, national security state capture.
Or the horrible responsibility of governance.
Yeah, I guess you could look at it either way. I mean, I tend to think that one of the things Matt Iglesias has made this point, and I've sort of written about it and made this point in different ways. It's amazing the distinction between the gravitas and force of the recommendations from the generals compared to other elements of the American bureaucracy. So you would never think that the head of the IRS would get a veto on tax policy or leak a memo saying that, the U.S. needs to have higher marginal tax rates on the wealthy to raise revenue. It's not, that's – we would just dismiss that.
Right.
But a general saying that he needs more troops creates very real political pressure on the president to, quote-unquote, listen to the general. So there's this strange and I think very dysfunctional and dangerous relationship between the kind of force and inertia of the national security apparatus and whoever's occupying the White House.
Well, if I could put on my Robert D. Kaplan hat, and that would be the recent hat, not the Balkan Ghosts hat, there is a counterargument that the U.S. military since Vietnam War has restructured itself to let good ideas come to the top. Like, it's a pretty good think tank on its own, and it produces some good information. That's, I think, a narrow subset of what you're talking about, and I think the overall thing is completely right, that there's a jock-sniffing effect on, you know, the stately four-star guy testifying in Congress. Yeah. And you know, a halo effect around his head. And saw it. I mean, when I covered John McCain, he was always given this incredible gravitas because all he needed to say was, like, my friends, I have seen war, and it's such a terrible thing. I'm reluctant to go to war. And also, I am in favor of going to war with everybody. So people would say, oh, he hates war so badly that everything that he says about interventionism is you know, freighted with all this with wisdom and gravitas, when it really wasn't. I mean, he hits the same note, and it's the same note that you see now, the notes largely of applause from the sort of Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol Times, David Brooks today sort of had this very kind of tortured, but ultimately a kind of an apologia to the trend that you and I are maybe decrying a little bit more, which is that once you're in power, you know, why do you have this military, this fine military, laying around unless you intend to use it? And I think that force...
A Madeleine Albright paraphrase, we should add.
Yeah, Madeleine Albright paraphrase. And I think that force is just, it's huge, and it's bureaucratic, and it's also political. It's a bunch of different things wrapped in one. And for me, it's very difficult. I used to identify a lot more with Albrightian politics. I lived in Central Europe for 8 years, and that really influenced the way I think about things, and Yugoslavia and stuff. And I've gone away from that for various reasons that I don't want to bore anybody with. But it's a difficult puzzle. But at some point, you start thinking, you know, just on a game theory basis, we are swelling up our responsibility for the world, you know, indefinitely. It's not nothing is restraining that, and that can't be healthy. Is my analysis.
I agree, and I feel I feel similarly. You know, on this sort of humanitarian, liberal internationalist, Wilsonian realist axis, I feel similarly kind of indeterminate. I mean, I guess my primary sort of commitment is, you know, anti-imperialist, and also just generally very extremely skeptical of military intervention and war as just as a failure. A war is always a failure. It should be a state of emergency. It's something that we do way too much of, and, you know, all things, unless there's some, in the absence of something super super immediately compelling, is to be avoided. But I also think, in terms of the halo effect, you know, in some ways, I think this is the poison. So one thing that always bothered me during the Bush years was the kind of chicken hawk argument, which I understood and I think is sort of legitimate insofar as it goes. But the problem with it is that the implied rhetorical foundation of it is that members of the military have a kind of higher judgment on these issues.
Yeah.
And that there's the other side of that coin, which is that when the generals say we need more troops, you know, we've invested that kind of reputational capital in the military. And I think that's really problematic. I mean, a project I'm working on, I've been looking at this data about American trust in institutions, and it's basically down precipitously in everything except for one thing since 2000, and that's the military, which is actually the only institution in American life that a majority of Americans say they, quote, have a lot of trust in the general social survey. I think that's problematic for our politics in a lot of ways, and some of which we're kind of reaping in this Afghanistan conversation.
You know, as part of that, I saw this week, and you probably did too, if this is what you've been working on, the Pew Center for the People in the Press came out with a new research bit about American attitudes, and their headline on it was isolationism at an all-time high, or the highest point in four decades. I think maybe the terminology isn't precise in that case, but just that Americans seemed less interested in going out there and being responsible for the world's affairs. Something like 49% responded yes or no to the question at hand. And there was just an overall demonstrated fatigue about Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that's a tension. I mean, when you have that amount that's growing, and there's no reason at all that it won't continue to grow. I mean, it's not as if the rate of killing is going down. Yeah, things are not getting better. It's not as if, you know, your friends and relatives in the military aren't seeing their third and fourth and fifth tours, all this kind of stuff. And in general, the economy is not going to get, you know, noticeably better in the next couple of years, probably. So the whole context is going to be worse. And yet you have this kind of permanent, at least, you know, semi-interventionism or engagement with the world militarily. And there is an unstable dynamic. And for me, a very interesting one, someone who kind of hates the two major political parties. It's interesting. And even though there's definitely fair warning from Obama's point of view in terms of that he campaigned on increasing engagement in Afghanistan and Pakistan for sure and every single day and all this kind of stuff. The fact is he was widely perceived, and a lot of his early juice came from the perception that he was an anti-war candidate, even though he's maybe just that war over there. And the only other person who was really getting any kind of anti-war juice is Ron Paul on the Republican side and also on the independent side. But Ron Paul has no power. He's a very marginalized person in many ways. So, you know, what are you left with? I think it's going to be fascinating going forward to see whether anybody who is vying for power on the Republican side, and so far there really isn't anybody, is going
to...
it's telling that the Republican response to all this was to bring out John McCain again. That says to me that
limited government vacuum,
there's definitely a comeback with it, rhetorically and on the grassroots level on the Republican side for limited government, for stuff that they totally ditched out the window during the Bush years, suddenly is making a comeback. Everyone's getting in touch with their inner libertarian, and for us outer libertarians, that this has all been both interesting and kind of comedic. But the one area where you see none of this, for the most part, except on the sort of Ron Paul libertarian side of it, is in foreign policy. You just see, you know, more hawkery than usual. And that says to me that we're going to see going forward just a continuous disconnect that is going to be potentially very fruitful for somebody electorally.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's this question of where is the kind of isolationist right or anti-war right. I mean, there's a few – I mean, this congressman from Utah, 3rd District, Congressman Chaffetz, came out with a statement basically opposing the Afghanistan escalation. He's like a very, very conservative Republican.
So you had to hunt to a Utah congressional district to get your statement. Yeah. No, that's interesting.
So he came out, but I think part of the reason for this, in terms of the kind of small government, I mean, there's first of all, right, I just would like to point out the philosophical inconsistency between, you know, thinking that providing health insurance universally to Americans is just a problem of such, you know, impossible complexity and will engender so much rent seeking and corruption and costs that it's just insoluble for the government to take it on. And yet, you know, building a stable state in Afghanistan, you know, which has essentially never been done, or certainly never been done by a foreign occupier, that's a doable. That's within the ability of the American state. So that inconsistency aside, you know, the thing you're talking about in terms of back to the libertarian roots. I mean, I think the reason that it's harder for them to do it on foreign policy is that they always paid lip service to libertarian ideas in their rhetoric, even when they weren't, you know, actually legislating that way. But that's not true on foreign policy. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, they have become an interventionist, hawkish, and it's harder for them to make the U-turn there.
Yeah, I mean, and the patron saints within the GOP of libertarianism was always Barry Goldwater, right? And by extension, to some degree, Ronald Reagan. And both those guys are pretty hawkish.
Two go together very...
Yeah, and you know, there are a lot of tensions there. But at the same time, in the 94 kind of generation of Republicans, precisely because there was a Democrat waging foreign policy back then, got into some kind of post-Cold War anti-interventionism. You know, Jesse Helms was always holding Madeleine Albright hostage in Congress. And but that tendency, as far as I can tell, is really hard to find. But you can find it. Yeah. You know, George Will is always coming out against whatever war we're in. Right. You can see it in the opinion land, and maybe you can see it among some of the people who are going to, you know, Tea Party protests and stuff. But from my observation of specifically Tea Parties, almost nothing about war in the signage. Also nothing, as I pointed out in another fora, about stuff like race and affirmative action, which I think they've been unfairly tarred with. But during some of the speeches, you would hear occasional, like, we got to, you know, win the damn war or whatever they were talking about. And they'd always get a hearty harumph. It's definitely part of the Republican. I don't know about the sort of genuine limited government / libertarian, which only overlaps and only somewhat with Republicanism based on tradition as much as anything else. I don't know where the anti-interventionism is aside from people with the last name of Paul. Enough about these silly wars. You were just in China. What the hell were you doing, and when should we start bombing?
Oh, yeah, when should we start? Well, yeah, if I had to come away with one conclusion about China, it's that I can think of nothing more catastrophic than a future in which the U.S. and China have a very, you know, have essentially the equivalent of a Cold War or military rivalry. So,
because there's just too damn many of them?
It would be just disastrous for everybody on both sides of that equation, I think. So,
where'd you go?
So it was the U.S.-China Exchange Foundation, which is a nonprofit based in Hong Kong, started by a guy named Chihua Tung, who's sort of a fascinating figure. He's a billionaire shipping magnate who lived in the U.S. for years, moved back to Hong Kong to take over his father's shipping business, and then ran and became the first governor of Hong Kong under the Chinese after the takeover in 97. So he's very much, you know, I mean, one of the things that was interesting is that, you know, it was independent. I was sent by a nonprofit. It wasn't no government money, but, you know, there isn't really civil society in China the way there is here. And the state is enmeshed in all this stuff, and the Communist Party specifically. So we were kind of hosted by this think tank there, which is, I was told, was a sort of Chinese version of the Council on Foreign Relations, but was really, you know, an arm of the Chinese Communist Party. So I went to Shanghai, Chongqing in the interior, the Three Gorges Dam, and also Beijing. And it blew my mind. Have you ever been to China?
No.
You know, it's really, I don't want to sort of filibuster. I'm sort of writing a piece on it. So I'm trying to save some of the insights such as they are, but you know, it's unlike anything I've ever seen. I think, you know, from a sort of world historical perspective, the urbanization and industrialization of essentially 800 billion people, is something unprecedented.
Yeah.
At the scale, scope, and pace with which it's happening, it is both. I mean, my kind of one sentence summary is that it's both amazing and monstrous. You know, it's like kind of like watching the pyramids get built in real time.
Yeah.
Like they're incredible. You know, but the way they're getting built is not so incredible.
Yeah, and there's a great piece that I commend to you if you haven't read it already. I think it won a National Magazine Award 2 years ago. It was in a National Geographic about basically the making and unmaking of a Chinese boomtown. It started with a guy sitting and in 26 minutes, like, sketching out his factory and making all his deals with the architect and the landowner and stuff. It is that sort of sense of monstrousness, or just like the willy-nilly way in which sort of individuals can get thrown around in the process. And at the same time, it's also people are very much empowered as part of the process. Like, a hero of the story becomes a 15-year-old girl who lies about her age to get a job, and she's really headstrong. And, you know, by the end of it, she's gone from being like a villager who's very shy and fearful to someone who's managing the finance of her parents back in the village and getting them moved out.
Right.
And it all takes place in a matter of like a day and a half. It's just it's a stunning piece of work, but the velocity will throw your head straight back. So I can only imagine what it's like in person.
Yeah, no, I would love to. I mean, I haven't read that piece, but that's, you know, I mean, I was actually on the Maglev train. Talk about velocity, throw your head straight back. The fastest train in the world. It goes from you know, downtown Shanghai to the airport, it goes 430 kilometers an hour.
Awesome.
Which is kind of like sort of symbolizes the whole sort of feeling there. And yet in certain ways, you know, I mean, one of the things, so we'll maybe disagree on this, so this may be useful to talk about. I mean, one of the things I came away with is that, you know, China is viewed, I think in the U.S., because of its sort of the way that it's talked about, viewed as this kind of triumph of, you know, movement to free markets and neoliberalism, and obviously that's true at a certain level, but it's remarkable how much state planning is central to the enterprise there, how much state ownership. I mean, I don't think that's quite appreciated in the U.S. enough. And also, you know, hearing all this talk of planning, and we have these goals for industrial output, and we told the state-owned enterprises to hire more workers because there's a recession, and 80% of the banks are owned by the state, even if they're on publicly traded. You know, it has this. It sounds like, you know, because of our American discourse about this, that's like use. You know, it's like if your National Weather Bureau was using astrology or something like. But you know, planning, despite all of Hayek's critiques of it, and some of which are quite legitimate, you know, it works sometimes. And one of the places I think it's worked is that, you know, they have kept very tight reins on the financial sector there, and have not gone through the kind of massive bubble misallocation of capital that's happened in liberalized capital markets the last 10 years.
Well, yeah, but they've also done that as they do with a lot of things, at the direct expense of their citizens. You know, I mean, there are rules on what kind of currencies you can have, and currency is artificially deflated at most vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar, and they will directly impede on the wealth of their own citizens, and especially the privacy rights. I mean, you went to the Three Gorges Dam, which is literally the most like monstrous public works project this side of the last time Nicolae Ceaușescu thought to redesign Bucharest. And, you know, yeah, you can build a highway pretty quickly there. In fact, when I was at the LA Times editorial board, we had one of our, you know, regular meetings with Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, and he had just come back from, I think it was Shanghai. And before we got down to talk about whatever the hell it was, why the union needs even more pension money, I think it was, I was just making chit chat with him, like, you know, how was Shanghai or China or wherever the hell he was, and he had this interesting gleam in his eye, and said something like, you know, yeah, it's amazing how quickly you can get things done there.
Right. No, I mean that's true, and I think that, you know, I think, you know, to a libertarian, that's just sort of unilaterally odious. But I think, you know, there's a seductiveness to that, I think.
It's an awful seductiveness. And, you know, I think it's an open question on how things would play out in an area where you had more political rights and more property rights, which go hand in hand.
No, absolutely. I think that's exactly the question. And I think that, I mean, for me, one of the things I was saying, I was having breakfast with Raihan this morning, Raihan Salam. And, you know, for me, one of the things I think I came away thinking, aside from the fact that fundamentally that the social contract which they've struck in China, which is basically we, the government, provide between 8 to 10% GDP growth a year and 24 million new jobs a year, and in exchange for kind of tacit consent to not question the fundaments of the state, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there's criticism allowed on our economic policy. There's criticism saying, why, you know, you can publish an essay saying, why are you buying all these dollars, or, you know, XYZ. What you can't say is, let's have elections, you know, et cetera. The irony is that social contract is partly born of this obsession with stability, which every single Chinese official will invoke overall, but of course it's less stable, right?
It's ultimately less stable, but you know, in the short term, it's certainly more stable, and it's a challenge, I think, to anyone of any kind of political belief or orthodoxy, because it's going to fly in the face of something. You know, for me, I mean, I just have the main story of X hundred million people coming out of poverty by using even, you know, a highly authoritarian flavor of capitalism is itself just kind of a wonderment and something that we should celebrate and also, you know, recognize as something that's incredibly dynamic and we don't know where it's going to go.
Right. But this is what I want to say, is that the the authoritarian capitalism that has produced that outcome, the authoritarian part of it is part of the outcome.
Right.
You know what I mean? That you can't – it's like I understand this sort of pull for libertarians to kind of like sort of celebrate the good and detach it from the bad. But like that's the confounding thing about China, is that like you can't do that.
Right.
Because yes, it's this unleashing of this entrepreneurial spirit, and that's part of it. And there's a certain part of it that can be a kind of convenient narrative of the kind of triumph of free markets, etc. But that is intimately tied to the massive, you know, investments and structured investments of the government. The fact that the government is, you know, won't let people move to the cities, right? Using this kind of anchor system called a hukou, which is your kind of provincial registration, so that this sort of transference is, you know, as orderly as possible. Now that's horrible to limit this freedom of movement, right? But you don't have essentially Mumbai slums. I mean, so all these connections, I think, are difficult to break apart, both from a kind of libertarian perspective and from a sort of left perspective. That China kind of provides ammunition and refutation for a lot of the political economic arguments that we make here in the States.
Which is great on many ways, especially if the grade of outcome is in a good way. I tend to think that, and it would make sense that I would tend to think this, that we know less about what's going on and causes and effects and all that than we think we do, down to actual number of GDP growth. What are the uglier aspects of keeping this whole thing in line? And also, what are some positive things that we don't even know what's happening? I mean, there are, I'm sure, regions of the country that, you know, no Westerner set foot in that is hatching all kinds of wonderfulness that we can only guess at. But one thing that really disturbs me, to bring it back to the mother country, is the fact that, speaking about what Obama was campaigning against, he was pretty damned anti-China in a kind of direct and, for me, ugly way in terms of jobs. I mean, whenever he was talking about Detroit, it's like, well, we're gonna create these 5 million green jobs with a magic leprechaun and make sure that they can't go to China. I mean, China was always the bugaboo in his you know, nightmare scenarios about international trade and everything else. And it struck me as I mean, even in his big race speech, which I was a fan of, not everybody was, but I thought was pretty great during the campaign, there was a section, and I invite you to go back and read it, where he was just at his most moving best, and, you know, we have to get beyond where you're from and national origin, blah, blah, blah. And the real thing that unites us all is that we're losing jobs to China. It's like, bro, did you hear what you just said? And on September 11th of all the days, you know, his first major trade decision as president was to slap a 35% tariff on Chinese-produced tires, which is launching a trade tit-for-tat that could escalate or could not. I fear that it might. And to me, that just that is the absolute wrong direction we need to go. And his phraseology defending it was, well, you know, we can't give China a free pass at the expense of U.S. workers. And that just, you know, that's a very pre-Al Gore versus Ross Perot kind of moment. And I think a worrisome thing in a international climate where free trade, which I think is a very, you know, even if it's as managed and as screwed up as it is in many ways on these overlapping trade agreements, it is still the best anti-poverty program anyone's come up with. So to go in the opposite direction of that in this sort of false zero-sum arguments about the all-important U.S. domestic tire consumption pie to split up, I think is a troubling thing, and I hope that he is restrained by someone from following up too much on those kind of instincts. What do you say, Asian person?
Yeah, I disagree. I disagree in certain ways. I mean, I don't think the tariff thing was a big deal. It was recommended by the, you know, the civil servants and. There's one way in seeing it as a trade war. There's another in seeing it as sort of enforcing what the trade mechanisms are. I mean, that, you know, we would talk all the time that the Chinese would complain about protectionism. Their fears of protectionism or rising protectionism in the U.S. And when you talk to them about the currency manipulation, which is a form of protectionism, they would always say, well, we can't, you know, we need to control the value of the currency. And my feeling is actually, like, I guess I'm sort of the opposite in the sense that, like, I think both of those are fine. I think that, you know, the managedness of this is a part of the kind of political nature of political economy between the two countries. I think that there's, you know, there's evidence that their currency manipulation does some good stuff. I mean, I just was reading a piece today, which I can't recall who wrote it, about kind of the currency manipulation essentially being a part of why China hasn't suffered, massive decline in GDP in this past year. And that's generally good for both China and the U.S. And I think that, you know, the bigger problem here is that China and the U.S. have an incredibly strange and I think in some senses dysfunctional relationship, the terms of which have been negotiated exclusively kind of by the elites in both countries and is constantly at the risk of populist backlash in both countries. I mean, one of the number one selling books in China right now is a book called Currency Wars, which is all about how the U.S. is going to devalue the dollar and screw the Chinese out of billions of wealth. It's very popular. And, you know, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I guess my answer to that is that we need, like, we need to revive, you know, international solidarity between working people in both countries. And I'm not quite sure the vessel for doing that.
Yeah. I just want to point out because it was on the top of my mind and I feel remiss in not bringing it up. But Thomas L. Friedman, one of the worst columnists writing in the English language, had a super dreadful piece like 6 or 8 weeks back talking about how, you know, Republicans in America are so terrible that it would be preferable to have democracy like they have in China. I'd rather have a...
No, I know. That was a remarkable, remarkable piece of writing.
Sense of the word remarkable. And I think that there's a great authoritarian temptation there among people. It's the one that, you know, Villaraigosa was saying in jest, but Friedman was saying in reality. And ultimately, that is, I think, on the side of the devil. Did I say that?
Yeah. Yes, I think we're in agreement on that. I think that we're in agreement on that. Although maybe the temptation runs stronger in me.
Yeah.
But
no, I mean there's when central planning works, you know, one time out of 100, it can be a breathtaking thing. I love
right.
There are few things that I love
more.
I think that's
our difference. I think
Timberline
Lodge
in Portland, Oregon.
What's that?
It's a beautiful WP era piece of architecture where they shot the exteriors of The Shining on Mount Hood, and it's just is about the most gorgeous hotel you can imagine, and it's like totally cost inefficient, and it's a WPA boondoggle, and I, you know, I hope to stay there sometime in the near future because it's gorgeous. You see, central planning.
Sorry, I'm writing an email right now because I'm getting bugged by someone, and I don't want...
You're writing an email? Watch this. Well, I was flipping off my colleagues who were trying to distract me about things over there, but I'm off the camera.
So I'm apologizing to both you and the Bloginhead viewers. I was getting pestered by someone who wanted something right away.
That's right. I'll talk. Keep typing.
No. We're good. No, I think So I think that we're in agreement on the sort of the temptations and maybe disagreement on how many times out of 10 it can work.
Yes. you just wrote a piece about In the Nation magazine, the world's oldest United States political magazine.
The world's
yeah.
oldest. Yeah.
About, as you put it, sort of the worrying trend lines of Americans believing less and less both that climate change is happening but especially is like an urgent problem of any sort. Before I obviously rip that all into shreds, lay out your case for how and why you see that happening and so forth.
Well, I just, you know, there's this public opinion data that I don't think it's surprising that people find it less urgent because I think everything has been supplanted by the immediacy of the economy. But there's a decline, you know, measured across several polls that I think is real and somewhat relatively precipitous when you look at year over year and the amount of people that believe that, you know, humans are the cause of global warming. Part of that, I think, is because the last few years have been relatively temperate and people have a tendency to kind of that affects their thinking. But I think the theory I advanced the column is basically that there was this big rhetorical shift in the way that cap and trade was messaged from, you know, we're going to fry the earth to we're going to create clean jobs and energy independence. And I understand why that shift was undertaken, because I think that all the polling and focus groups suggested the latter message was more effective. But I think it's been shifted so wholly that Democrats and other people like myself who want to see climate legislation passed have kind of abandoned the field of the fundamental argument about actual climate change, and that's left a vacuum that has caused this decline. So that's my kind of – the point of the column is that you have to – that basically you can't – ultimately at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to pass climate legislation as a kind of bait and switch in which you don't talk about the climate. You have to talk about the climate.
Why did the word climate gate not show up in your column?
Yeah, well, so I've been getting emails about this. I mean, I sort of first talked about it, and I wrestled with how to sort of talk about it, and then I was kind of like, well, I'm not going to toss this off in a sentence or two because I kind of have longer thoughts about that. So I sort of saved it to try to write about in some other way, but I probably should have made mention of it.
I mean, that to me, and I am someone who does not follow the science or much of even the debate about the science of global warming. I am probably like a lot of other people, kind of rationally ignorant. I assume that it's happening. It helps that at Reason, which has a 41-year track record of being very skeptical towards environmental claims, you know, our science correspondent is really great, Ron Bailey. He looks at the data and has for years and years, and came to the cautious conclusion that yes, this is happening. I tend to believe Ron more than I believe other people. But all that said, I think this week and this scandal is kind of the biggest hit on the overall believability of the narrative. I mean, if you're getting back to the basics of let's focus on climate change and instead of green jobs, which I, from a political tactic, I couldn't agree with you more, since the green jobs is a pile of bullshit.
Well, I don't think that's true, but I think it's easily oversold. Let's say that.
Yeah, I mean the 5 million green jobs was the single or the second biggest term at the Democratic convention. The first one being that John McCain owns seven houses, and you know it's pretty to think so. But if you're going to make fossil fuels more expensive, which any piece of climate change legislation presumably will do, then, you know, there are fossil fuels related jobs in the United States too, and you're going to lose those. And, you know, there was a study by the King Juan Carlos University in Spain talking about Spain's experience with, I think, going to wind and solar for X percentage of their jobs, and they, or for their electricity, and they experienced a pretty significant, according to the study, job loss. I mean, and right. Based on this stuff. So, if you're going to get down to the climate change, which I think you should do, definitely going to need to grapple with the fact that it seems that one of the kind of major centers for this study of it academically has gone through this interesting and strange scandal, which I'm busy not following.
Yeah, I mean, I have paid sort of marginal attention to it. I mean, from what I can tell, there were two or three cases of genuine kind of malfeasance. You know, people, you know, making a reference to something not getting published, and another about running some sort of statistical method that'll make something pop more. And you know, I think to the degree that there's you know, genuine malfeasance, and people should, you know, suffer professional consequences for that. I just think that, you know, the amount of data there is on climate change is just it's massive. The amount of peer-reviewed work that's been published on it, we know much more about both carbon emissions in the U.S. and the warming of the Earth than we know about all sorts of other things. I mean, it's been studied far more, and with more with more kind of scientific community attention and back and forth and debate than lots of other things that, you know, there's tons of people who are on you know, psychotropic drugs that we know extremely little about how they function.
Right.
So I think that, you know, I think that the notion, I just think it's, you know, I actually don't have a ton of tolerance for people that are pointing to this as some great smoking gun. I just think it isn't. And if you go back and look at what's actually being said there, there's a whole range of things, and the places in which you really step into, like, you know, genuine epistemic sins is like two or three cases. But that just does not invalidate. I think there's something, but I forget how the number of sort of peer-reviewed articles there have been, you know, looking at some aspect of this.
The one thing that I found surprising about it all, and again, my looking at this is totally superficial, but just in other people's description, was kind of how narrow a very key subset of data was being treated. It's basically like this group has been dealing with this narrow set of data, and I would have thought that that was more widely shared. But with that, I should retire from the actual discussion of that.
Let's talk about the green jobs thing, because I actually want to respond to that. And so there's two ways, right? So yes, you know, if you increase the cost of fossil fuels, or the fossil fuel industry shrinks, you lose jobs in that. There's two ways that some sort of macroeconomic shift is going to bring jobs, right? More domestic production, right? Or something is more labor intensive than capital intensive, right?
For the sake of argument, let's go on. Yeah.
Well, I mean, those are the way that, I mean, those are how something, you know, industry A versus industry B can, you know, have more jobs associated with it. And I think there are very plausible, in some cases persuasive, arguments that both one or two or possibly both of those will hold, if, you know, a green jobs program is undertaken. You know, that's particularly true around efficiency, because efficiency is necessarily not outsourceable. And, you know, depending on how clean energy is developed, it can be true also about labor intensiveness.
So what? what is this efficiency of which you speak, and how is it?
Right. So if you weatherize every building in the country, right, that has to be done in the U.S.
If you want, I'm sorry. What kind
of, I say if you weatherize every building in the country, right, that has to be done in the U.S.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So there are, you know, there are jobs that are tradable jobs, and there are jobs that are not tradable jobs, right?
Yeah.
Home healthcare, not a tradable job until we have, you know, remote robots. Making shoes, tradable job.
Right.
So to the extent that things shift from tradable jobs to non-tradable jobs, you can see. I'm just saying that there's, you know, whether the actual models are themselves predictive is a sort of empirical question, but there's no reason theoretically that it's hooey.
Well, I guess what troubles me in every case is when a politician, and more importantly, someone who actually holds power, so someone who won the election, is tossing out these incredibly vague and unscientific formulations about jobs that they literally, I mean, part of this, in fact, there was a Van Jones tie-in, if I remember correctly. I think he was the one sort of talking about the need for couching all this in terms of green jobs and all this kind of stuff. And Van Jones, very charismatic, interesting, weirdo guy. You know, would you describe him as an economist who understands about, you know, the cause and effect of economic policy on jobs? I don't think that's an accurate way of describing our friend Van Jones. And yet some of this ideas and terminology did come directly from the guy. So to hear this from politicians without any regard to what are the pricing points currently for these technologies. We had a great cover story in July from Ron Bailey, again, saying, okay, well, what's the kilowatt hour for this? How much does it cost now? How much did it cost 20 years ago? And what's a realistic expectation of what it's going to cost 20 years from now? You know, in order to make as much energy from a single nuclear plant, you'd have to, like, cover 50 miles of the Mojave Desert with solar panels. I mean, there's an unrealisticness about the discussion on these things that can be a little bit crazy-making, especially in an era where, for a lot of people, nuclear is just taken off the table preemptively because of storage and radioactivity kind of things. A lot of people want to take, and I'm one of them, not normally for a libertarian necessarily, but who don't like hydroelectric power because it messes up our rivers, damn it. But people don't have these serious conversations. They just say, 5 million green jobs, it's all going to be great. It's win, 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 as Thomas Friedman would say. And it's based on fantasy. If you raise prices – which they have done and which they will continue to do with any kind of legislation, you're going to make things more expensive for everybody. That is not something that creates jobs. That is usually the opposite. I mean, we just raised the requirements on the U.S.-owned auto manufacturers. So they're, you know, they're going to, on average, by car, hike up the price to consumers by $1,600 within the next X number of years. When you make stuff more expensive, people buy less of it. I don't see how that is going to create any kind of jobs. And I think to the extent of which, I mean, even in the stimulus, you know.
Matt, that's pretty cramped economic reasoning. I mean, to say that when you make something more expensive, people buy less of it, that how can that create any other jobs? The point is that the way the capital is allocated is not fixed and it flows in different directions, right? So yes, certain industries shrink and certain industries grow. If the industries that shrink are less labor intensive than the industries that grow, then you create jobs. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily going to happen, and I agree there's a sort of fairy tale quality to the discussion. I'm just saying that it's just not the case that there's just not a theoretical framework for this happening. I mean, it can't happen. If it's going to happen, I mean, and the fact of the matter is the amount of power that the fossil fuel industry has and sort of kind of incumbent players has makes it, you know, less likely that it will happen, right? Because they're going to try to sort of do everything they can in the legislation to subvert that outcome.
Including sucking up subsidies to develop new green technologies, which...
Right, they will. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of kind of public choice critiques one can offer the cap and trade bill. And, you know, some of them I think are fairly right on. And to me, it's kind of like, you know, was it Lenin who said you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet?
You went there, I did.
So,
oh, by the way, look on your Nation website. There are you can get Noam Chomsky gnomes and I think a Karl Marx plush doll as part of your...
Yes, I like the Noam Chomsky garden gnome, actually. Anyway, so look, I think that there is a degree of... and we have actually written this in the magazine, to be honest. A degree of unreality and fairy tale kind of like the win-win-win vision of green jobs is an appealing message and not always as tethered to reality as I, you know, one would like. Again, though, and this I think, you know, this goes back to the broader discussion of climate change, which is that, you know, I am sympathetic and I feel a real sense of urgency about this issue that I don't think people share. And that creates a kind of, you know, political imperative for corner cutting that I don't necessarily think is bad because that's the way things sort of always happen politically. I mean, there's, you know, LBJ on the phone talking about sort of, you know, how to kind of do the accounting on Medicare so it looks less expensive. Which is shady, but at the end of the day, like, I'm really glad we passed Medicare.
You know, but at the end of the day, it makes new claims less believable, and I think it's a strategic mistake for Obama to tie in a pretty difficult to believe and certainly fraught with peril kind of 5 million green jobs claim at the same time that you're talking about climate change, which is something
right,
that
no,
for,
I, and
for
I do think I think
better
right.
or for ill. There's a group of people who are very unconvinced about that or who are on the fence or don't
right.
really know. And I think some of the dynamism that you pointed to in your piece about public opinions about it shifting shows that there's sort of a softness of the public opinion.
Yes.
And I think a lot of that is because it's perceived as a partisan squabble more than it's perceived
yes, right.
as settled science.
Yes, but that is because there is a very well-funded group of people who are committed to making it look that way and a political party that is down the line associated with. I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
well, I would say it's also partly because, you know, there's this other political party that you may have heard of that has power, and their former vice president is the head of the sort of movement
sure,
on the
right.
other side. I mean, it is politicized on both sides, and I think even the, you know, to the extent ClimateGate is relevant to that part of the discussion, there's, you know, all science is vulnerable to kind of political pressure or group things, even in small and only vaguely political ways. And so in a strong way, I kind of agree with your overall take that for those who share your beliefs, I mean, it really should be about this topic. I mean, if this is going to happen as badly as you think.
I am arguing in some ways. I mean, my fundamental point is that you can't cut corners, and that the policy has to be sold on its merits, and that you can't sell a climate change bill to the American people and not talk about climate. And you need to, you know, we have to do whatever it takes to make that the fundamental point stick. So I'm basically on, anyway, we're sort of in agreement on that. That was the point of the column.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm trying to not be, I don't want to be too dilettantish, because there are people who work very hard on this who I have a tremendous amount of respect for and, are trying to push things through a political process that's incredibly thorny and difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, and we should wrap up on this topic now, because we're at the 1 hour mark. But I think a fundamental problem that Obama will face once we get to cap and trade, which we can only do after healthcare, will be that there isn't a lot of track records for caps and trades working out there in the world. I think it sort of points, if anything, to the opposite direction. So the more that you make these political deals from a, you know, existing ground of something that may or may not work, the harder it's going to be to accept to people, especially if any part of the solution ends up raising anybody's price on anything. And you can't pass, you cannot pass a significant piece of climate change legislation without raising people's prices, I don't think. But with that,
no, that's exactly true. I mean, that is the last thing you say. I wouldn't agree on cap and trade, but the last thing you say is definitely indisputably right, which is that the central issue is that the price of fossil fuels has to go up, and that's not fun when the price of fossil fuels go up. Now, of course, the irony here is that you can make them go up, and then you can rebate the rebate the income, so it ends up being a transfer. But what's happened is that those credits have been, you know, to get the bill passed, you have to bribe the incumbent players.
Right. All right. Well, with that, we should stop. But thank you very much. It's been a very fun conversation.
Yeah, that was fun.
We'll look forward to reading all about China in the Nation.
Yeah, you bet. Talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.